Hello, pod people and bog people, especially Pete. This is Material World. I'm Quentin Cooper. And after a couple of weeks on the road, we're back live, except this being a podcast, not live anymore, if you know what I mean. Today, we're hot and dry and cold and wet. Later, we'll consider an unconventional approach to meeting our growing demand for electricity and heat energy. Not solar power or wave or tidal or any of the other usual suspects, but hot, dry rocks. That burst of alternative rock will come after we step gingerly into the world of the bog people.
Stapleton laughed. "That is the great Grimpen Mire," said he. "A false step yonder means death to man or beast. Only yesterday I saw one of the moor ponies wander into it. He never came out. I saw his head for quite a long time craning out of the bog hole, but it sucked him down at last. Even in dry seasons, it's a danger to cross it. But after these autumn rains, it's an awful place."
That, from the Hound of the Baskervilles, is the bog-standard attitude to many wetlands, be they mires, swamps or other sodden, soggy sites. The names all connote something best not to get into and hard to get out of. Become mired in controversy, swamped with work or just plain bogged down, and you risk ending up in a slough of despond. And yet there's more to and more of wetlands than being an awful place. They're around 9% of the planet's total land surface, and they're critically important in regulating the atmospheric content of a number of gases, including carbon dioxide and methane. At the moment, they largely act as carbon sinks, often storing it as peat. But one possible, some think probable, climate change scenario is that as wetlands dry out, they may release vast amounts of carbon dioxide. But then they also may have a key part to play in countering the effects of rising sea levels, with more low-lying areas becoming wetlands. We're going to attempt to navigate our way across this treacherous terrain with the help of Dr. Vince Gauchy, lecturer in Earth Systems and Ecosystem Science at the Open University, and Dr. Colin Lloyd, research fellow at the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology at Wallingford. Vince Gauchy, sorry for giving you the older form of, longer form of your name. Why do we have all these negative ideas about wetlands?
Well, I mean, I do think it's a bit unfair that they've got this maligned reputation. But you can see where it comes from. They're sort of difficult terrain to cross, as was covered in that reading there. But also, I mean, there's a link with disease. A lot of these areas, I mean, they harboured all sorts of insects that would give malaria, for example, to local populations. So
not just mal-lined, but mal-air-ear as
exactly.
Well. It's that whole association with them.
Absolutely. But it's only really recent times that we've started to appreciate the real use that they bring to human populations. I mean, all sorts of things. You mentioned hydrology there. I mean, they do absorb floodwaters, for example. So if you drain these types of ecosystems, then you get a flashier flood, for example. But yeah, they absorb massive amount of carbon, and that's one of the things that we're talking about today.
And Colin Lloyd, I mean, and as I mentioned there, they are a huge part of the Earth's surface in all their many different forms as well.
Well, yes, and they're a very important part. In the past, they have kind of absorbed up to about a third of the world's soil carbon when they were cold and wet. And the probability is now that even if they stay wet but get warmer, they will start to actually give up that carbon in terms of either carbon dioxide or in terms of methane.
So. And this is the reason to do the kind of research that you're both being involved in, is because we're not exactly sure to what degree and under what circumstances, what degree of climate change is going to be needed for those circumstances to come into force.
Well, yes. I mean, wetlands are probably one of the most complex ecosystems we have. Not only do they involve water, they involve a complete melange of different gases that can come out of the soil, go into the soil, into the vegetation. It's a real mixture that is very difficult to tease apart in terms of measurements, in terms of what goes on in those areas.
Okay, we've had maligned malaria and melange already at the start of this as well. So Vince, in your particular area, your biogeochemistry, and you're particularly interested in the gases that are coming in and going out.
Absolutely. I'm particularly interested in the methane. And you touched on the fact that climate is to some extent affected by the processes that go on in these peatlands and wetlands in general. Now, if you look at methane, it's particularly important because you've got a gas there that's more than 20 times more powerful than CO2. So it's really important in terms of greenhouse warming. But also, it only lasts in the atmosphere for about 10 years or so. So it's really quite sensitive to shifts in the sources and sinks of this gas. So given that peatlands and wetlands are a big source of this gas and they respond to climate change, we need to know how that gas ultimately is affected by these processes and how it could feed back to the climate system.
And are we talking about systems here where a relatively small shift, you know, a shift of 1 degree, 2 degrees, whatever, may be absorbed, but you may suddenly reach a trigger and suddenly you've got a great belch of methane coming out of our bogs?
Absolutely. I mean, there's some work that's gone on in the high northern latitudes where some of these thaw lakes, these lakes that would normally be frozen over, have been thawing, and a lot of this methane has been locked away in the soil, and since
this
it's been
the Siberian permafrost. Absolutely. And things like this.
Yeah, and you just need to raise it by a couple of degrees, and it's, the Arctic ecosystems are particularly sensitive to changes in climate, and they're also getting the biggest climatic shifts. So it's quite important to look at these areas.
And Colin, I think your gas of choice is carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide, and also a different scale. We need a double approach here. We need an approach that looks at what is actually going on between the gases and within the soil. But we also need a budget idea, certainly at this point in time, to gain an idea of a global budget of what the actual carbon dioxide and methane is coming out, is really what modellers need in some ways. The actual processes are built into the models, but you need this actual budget idea as to what the world is doing at present.
And like any other budget, you need to know what's in the bank. So how do you, if you're going to get your modelling, how do you get that data? How do you measure how much carbon dioxide is in a bog,
well,
or other wetland?
Well, the way that I tend to do it, and I'm not just the only person, a lot of groups around the world do it, is effectively we come out of the bog and we measure above the bog at the interchange between the surface, the soil, the vegetation and the atmosphere. We see what the mixture is there, and then we measure what the actual concentration of CO2 and methane is as it passes past our sensor. And by this method, we can actually gain a big aerial average of the actual concentrations of gases coming out. And we can do that over months, we can do that over years. So not only do we manage to gain an idea of an aerial average, but we actually also look at the interannual variability of those gases.
And you say your sensor, what is the sensor you use to measure these
things?
Well,
it's quite complicated. We literally have a very, very high-speed sonic anemometer, which measures the...
Sonic anemometer. Coming soon to a Doctor Who episode near you, yes.
That's right. It's a bit like that. You measure the speed of sound with an instrument, and then you can convert that into the various vectors of the wind speed, the ones that are going horizontally, vertically and across wind. The only one you want to worry about is the vertical one, because that's the one that's moving gas concentrations away from the surface. You then have an infrared gas analyzer, which effectively measures rapidly what the actual concentration of the air as it passes through its open gate.
Vince, same for you with methane?
Yeah, you can use these methods of what we call micrometeorological methods, but there are a number of other ways of looking at methane, both on a very small scale or local scale. For example, you can stick a box on top of a peatland and measure the change in concentration within that. Or you can go so far as to use satellites. And satellites have been used to try and estimate the actual column of concentration in the atmosphere. Now, what you have there, then, you have a basically what they call a top-down estimate of methane in the atmosphere. And one of the things that's puzzled many people is how do you reconcile that top-down estimate with the sources, all these different things that are contributing methane, for example, peatlands, rice paddies, etc.
And, I hadn't even thought rice paddies, of course.
Yeah.
They are kind of natural, or not, they're man-made wetlands as well as everything else.
They are, and they're susceptible to management strategies as well. So those are something we can do something about. But there has been a bit of a gap between the the way of measuring methane. The bottom-up measurements-based estimate is a